listening to Harrismith Radio. I'm your host, Wayne McPhail. In this episode, we meet the woman behind a remarkable Canadian documentary, First We Eat. Suzanne Crocker takes us behind the scenes of a film she made about the transformative year when she inspired her family to eat locally for 12 months in Dawson City, hard by the Arctic Circle, through the winter. Next up, Ontario farmer Ken Dam talks about going whole hog, eating pork from nose to tail as a way of honoring the animal. So, eating honorably and locally, all in this episode. By the way, if you want to read Harrismith magazine instead of listen to it, you can subscribe to the print version online at harrismithmag.com. And you can find Harrismith magazine on selected newsstands across Canada. But for now, settle in for the next half hour of Harrismith Radio. Dawson City, Yukon is a northern community of 1,500 people. 97% of the food for those folks is trucked in from thousands of kilometers away. Retired doctor, filmmaker, and mother, Suzanne Crocker, wanted to see what would happen if she and her family could eat completely closer to home for a year. No salt, no coffee, no tea, no oranges, or chocolate. Her coaxing resulted in an at-first resistant family eating only local produce, foragings, fish, and livestock for a year through a Yukon winter. And she decided to film the whole thing. The result is a remarkable portrait, not only of a family's resilience, but also of the bountiful land and a community of independent and inventive farmers, fisherfolk, and Indigenous elders ready to share their bounty and their wisdom. I spoke with Suzanne about that year and her documentary called First We Eat. She joined me from her home in Dawson City, Yukon. Suzanne, thanks very much for joining us. I think a lot of people watching the documentary would say, wow, that family went through a really interesting experience. It went through a really interesting experience on camera, but that wasn't the first rodeo for your family, both in terms of having that kind of extreme experience and also being part of a documentary. Can you talk a little bit about the prior documentary and how it sort of set the stage for what happened in this documentary?
For sure. First documentary is called All the Time in the World. It can be found at allthetimeintheworld.ca. And at that point, the kids were 10, 8, and 4, and my husband and I took them into the Yukon bush for the winter, and we spent 9 months living in a tiny cabin with no electricity or internet or phone or no road access, and just observed what happened. And I do feel like the two films are kind of bookends for each other, because in All the Time in the World, we were cooking, you know, with wood heat, we were chopping through the ice to haul our water in buckets, living entirely off-grid, but we had hauled in all our food. And with First We Eat, we were living back in town, back on the grid, but we were eating 100% locally. So I feel like the two experiences, I feel like I could meld them together and know that I could do both at the same time if I had to.
In terms of both experiences, why? Why did you decide to do that with your family? And some people would argue to your family.
Yeah, it depends on whose perspective you ask the question from. But, you know, the first experience with All the Time in the World, we went into the bush really because as a family, we needed to reconnect again. I think especially as parents, we were totally consumed by work and by computer and volunteer things. And as much as we tried to focus on family time and have family time, all these other things were always going on in our heads that distracted us and pulled us away. And we felt like our kids were growing up too fast and we're going to miss these precious years if we can't really focus. So I think it was kind of for me and Gerard, it was kind of like time of abstinence from any digital technology and other obligations and emails so that we could actually focus on our family and our kids. So it was all about disconnecting to reconnect. And we didn't go, you know, in neither case, the inspiration was not to make a movie. In both cases, the inspiration was to do something for the passion of doing it, and the decision to film it and share it through a documentary came second.
And how did that come about? I don't think you had a terribly filmic background, right?
My background is actually, I'm a medical doctor. I mean, that's what my training was. And I worked as a rural remote family doctor for years until I retired from that to spend more time with my kids, actually. But yeah, so how did that come about? Well, when my kids were young, they started getting into short filmmaking. When my eldest son, Sam, was 5, he started doing stop motion animation, and I was helping him figure that out. And in the process, I totally got bit by the filmmaking bug, and I started doing stop motion animation and making short films myself. And this community that I live in of Dawson City in the Yukon, even though it's tiny, like we're 1,500 people, but it's got so many creative people who live here, so many great filmmakers. We have an international short film festival every Easter weekend. And so there's lots of opportunity to just pick up a camera and take a workshop, give it a try. So I started to do that. And yeah, next thing I know, I just found I totally love storytelling through film. So when we decided to take the kids into the bush, there was so much curiosity, especially from folks down south, about what that would look like and why we would spend 9 months in the winter in the bush with 3 young kids, that I thought it was going to be really important to document it. And because I was so much enjoying storytelling through film instead of documenting it by journaling or writing about it, I thought I'd take the camera and document it that way. So that's how that came about.
A lot of people that may not pay attention to the credits may not realize that you're shooting that, or the GoPro by itself, or maybe in some cases some of your family members, you're the folks who are actually shooting the film, right?
Yeah, there's no external crew, which, you know, has its pros and its cons, of course. But I mean, certainly in the bush, it was necessary because we were totally isolated and there was nobody there but us. So I actually gave the tripod a credit in both my films because it's such an essential piece of equipment to be filming yourself. But you know, the advantage of that is, especially when you're filming your kids, is that they don't change their behavior whether the camera is on or off. In fact, when we filmed All the Time in the World, afterwards, I remember somebody at a screening asking my kids about what it felt like to be filmed. And Kate said, you know, when I watch the film, I remember everything that happened, but I don't actually remember anybody filming it. So the camera just kind of disappeared into the background, and that allowed them to be their own authentic selves, which I think really captures some amazing moments in both films.
And yeah, it did absolutely. Now, but the other thing about that I think is really challenging for you and fascinating to watch is, you know, especially in the scenes where there's dishes all piled up in the sink and you're spending days preparing food and stuff, that you're doing that and you're filming and you're having to do all the post-production related to the filming. I mean, that's an enormous amount of work.
Yes. Thank you for noticing that. I mean, people often ask after watching First Meet, you know, well, that's great what you did, but do you think you could still do that and have a full-time job? And my immediate answer is, well, yes, because actually I had 3 full-time jobs simultaneously while I was doing that. So yeah, it is a lot of work. And in hindsight, when I look back on it, I'm not quite sure how I pulled it off with only 24 hours in a day, but I'm a very determined person. And when I get in the mode of this is what I'm passionate about, this is what I'm going to do it, I think somehow I make it happen.
So I want to talk a little bit about your kids, because they're young adult, and they're willful, and they're teenagers, and you get the sense in the film that they're going along, but I also get the sense they must have snuck off for a burger at a girlfriend's house or something, right? Like, what happened behind the scenes there in terms of their engagement with the experiment?
As opposed to the first experience when we went into the bush, when they were totally on board with that, probably because they didn't actually understand what it really meant. other than a long camping trip. In this situation, when I told them what my plan was, they flatly refused. Like they were not impressed. So they were actually conscripted, I would say. You know, it wasn't until my husband came on board to agree not to bring any grocery store food into the house for that year that I knew I had my kids, because even though they are willful, they are not that willing to go do the grocery shopping. So that's when I knew I had them. But yeah, they were hard sells, and I thought I was going to win them over through their stomachs. You know, just the idea of me basically changed to the kitchen with the goal of cooking for them every day, I thought would win them over, but they were harder to win over than that. And they did for sure cheat. I mean, they do admit to that in the film. They often would be trading their dry meat at school for somebody else's sandwich. And so, you know, the rule was no grocery store food inside the house. But of course, they're teenagers and they've got their own lives to live outside the house. So there's no controlling them outside of the house, which I think is a good thing. I mean, it actually gave them some agency.
There's a point in the documentary about midway through where it looks like you're going to lose them, right? That they're going to bail. And then they don't bail. So what happened there?
Yeah, that was a difficult point for me, because we were, you know, we were halfway through and I really didn't want the experiment to fail. Again, I think they just sort of agreed to carry on because I wanted them to so badly. But I would also say about that time, things were getting better for them. At the beginning of the year, there was so much work to be done to gather, harvest, preserve enough food to get us through a year, especially when I had no idea how much food that would be, that there wasn't a lot of time for creativity in the kitchen. But once all that food was under my roof, then I had time to get a little more creative and spend a little more time trying different things. And then the food started to get better. I became a better cook. So that really helped them. And what was interesting is, like, once we passed that point, then it just kind of became the new reality for them. And there was much less resistance. I think also early on, I needed them to help because there's a lot to do. And, you know, you quickly realize that in times past, when people were homesteading on the farm and feeding themselves, the whole family was pitching in. And it's a different story if there's like one person trying to gather and create food for five people. It meant more chores for them, which also built up resentment. Yet once all that was finished, then I could let them off the hook more. So the food got better. They had fewer extra chores to do. All those things, I think, combined to make them think, okay, this is just the way we eat now, and it's not so bad after all.
So let's talk about the support you got outside of the house, because obviously your kids and your husband supported you inside the house for the year. But you had a sort of a remarkable community of farmers and, you know, livestock producers. I mean, just amazing array. So were they especially supportive to you, or is that just sort of the nature of them to be so helpful to one another?
Well, I think it's both. I mean, definitely I couldn't have done this on my own. I went into this as a blank page. I wasn't really a very good gardener. I didn't like cooking. I didn't know how to forage. So I knew from the get-go that this wasn't something that I could do on my own. And I certainly approached my community with my plan and found out if they were supportive, and they were, of course. But this is also an incredibly supportive and collaborative community, just in its very nature. We're on the traditional territory of the Trandaquichin, and the Trandaquichin are the backbone of this community. They're one of the first self-governing First Nations in Canada since 1998. And even when settlers first arrived in this area, there's this long history of Trandaquichin being very generous with their knowledge and very sharing. So the Trandaquichin here share the traditional knowledge with the whole community. Culture camps for youth are open to all youth, whether they're Indigenous or not Indigenous. Community feasts are open to everybody. So when I was doing this project, I was invited to attend all the culture camps, and the elders shared their knowledge. You know, they helped us harvest and cook the moose nose. They gifted me precious salmon eggs from the very first king salmon caught after a 5-year moratorium, and helped teach me how to forage wild plants that I previously had thought of as weeds. So all of that was amazing. And then we have this group of really resourceful farmers here. You know, they're all small family farmers. Many of them farm off grid. Many of them farm on rivers with no road access. So they're canoeing hay to their livestock. And they're just incredible people who have this eternal optimism, no matter what befalls them with weather and equipment breakdowns and all the challenges of farming in this area, they continue on. And yeah, so most of our food, I mean, I did have my own garden. I tried to grow as much as I could. I borrowed other people's gardens and greenhouses, but most of our food, you know, came from either the land or from what the farmers produced. And that was also part of the whole experiment. It wasn't so much what can I, Suzanne Crocker, produce, it's what can this community produce, and can we as a community sustain ourselves food-wise without having to ship 97% of our food thousands and thousands of kilometers away.
So I was really struck by the inventiveness of all of your neighbors. Like, it seems like everybody could do everything. Like, it was quite remarkable to see, you know, apples being grown that close to the Arctic Circle, and all of these fruit and vegetables. You think, wow, how is that possible up there? So these folks really had to go to extremes to be able to do this and to share their knowledge with you, right?
For sure. And I think Dawson attracts independent folks, you know, and because we're so remote, it's common that people become jacks of all trades, and also common that we share with each other. It's just an incredibly collaborative community.
So I want to talk about a particular point in the video that really struck me at a very poignant moment. It's near the end, where the experiment's over and you've told your family, hey, you can go to the grocery store and stock up on, you know, Hershey bars or whatever you want. And they do that, and they come back, and there's all of this, you know, processed food and some junk food and stuff, and they're sort of reveling in it. And the look on your face is of resignation or nostalgia or sadness that you thought that even though the experiment was over, the experiment would go on and they would change their minds about this, the food they're eating and everything. No, that didn't happen. Can you tell me about what you were going through in that moment?
I mean, those emotions you saw on my face were all very, very real. I was totally transformed by the experience of eating 100% local for a year. And I had hoped that my family also would have a transformative experience. So when they were at the grocery store, the moment it opened, the day after the year ended, it felt a bit like a failure to me. You know, that, okay, after all of this, that they'd learned nothing. But that was my sentiment in that moment. But hindsight now, some time has passed, and I understand it, of course, from their perspective much more clearly, and how exciting it would be to eat an orange again and a banana and some peanut butter.
Let's talk about more broadly about what people can learn from the experiment, because it was so extreme and so difficult that, you know, it's hard to imagine your experience, especially in that kind of environment, scaling well to 100 people or 1,000 people or 10,000 people, let alone across the world. And then there's a lot of people that just wouldn't do it. So what did you hope that the experiment would prove, and what has the experiment proved as far as the actual anecdotal evidence that you've seen as a result of the documentary?
You're right. It's not really that practical for most people to do what I did. I just have to say that it's quite an incredible feeling when you actually know where every single ingredient on your plate comes from, and you know the people, the animals, and the land that helped put it there. As I say, I was transformed by the experience. I continue to eat 90% local to my community, and even my community, you know, the whole local food movement has just continued to build in Dawson City, and we're it's amazing to see. So I know these movements are out there across the country and around the world, and hopefully the film will help inspire the movements that are already underway.
That was a resourceful Suzanne Croker. You can learn more about her film at firstweeat.ca. Ken Dam and his wife Claire run a small farm near Linden, Ontario. And on that farm they have some hogs, hogs that the couple wanted to honor by making sure they didn't waste a bit of the goodness in the animal. So they decided to eat from nose to tail, struggling with gelatinous head cheese and salty prosciutto along the way. Here's Ken's tale of how that turned out. Hey, Ken, thanks very much for joining us. Before we start talking about how you approach eating a pig, let's talk about where you are right now. You're in a farm in Linden. Tell me a little bit about the farm.
It's a smaller farm in Linden. It's about 17 acres. Half of it is actually usable. So we only got about less than 10 acres to really work with as far as raising animals, so far anyway.
One of the things you're raising is hogs. And I want to talk to you about your approach, the sort of tail to nose or nose to tail approach to eating the pig. Because that strikes me, you know, and I think a lot of people listening might think, okay, nose to tail, that's a sort of a charcuterie hipster thing from 2018. But I get the sense that you're approaching this much more philosophically and much more practically, right?
Absolutely. I think when we decided that we wanted to raise our own animals and our own meat for the purposes of feeding ourselves and our family, when you do that, you really have to come to terms with the fact that you are killing an animal. You develop a relationship with these animals, and then you have to end their life for the purpose of eating them. And so when you become that intimate with what you're going to eat, there's inevitably a push within yourself to want to honor this animal the best you can. And so that's kind of the approach for us, I guess, on a philosophical basis or an emotional basis, that we want to honor the animals that we're raising here. And one way to do that is to really use the whole animal and not waste any parts of it as much as we can.
It's not an approach that's easy, right? I mean, in the piece that you wrote for Harrismith, you talk about the challenges of making like decent head cheese, for example, of boiling, you know, and I like the way you talk about it. All you have to do is boil it down for 24 hours and make the gelatin and scrape the meat off. And there you go, you got some head cheese. So yeah. It wasn't an easy thing for you guys to do, right?
No, that's right. There's all sorts of new skills you have to learn to try and create recipes that are edible, really, and actually taste good. And a lot of these things that we're working with, whether it's the offal, whether it's the meaning like liver or other organs, things that we don't normally cook with on a regular basis. Now we're faced with, okay, so we've got this rather large pig liver that we want to eat and have it taste good. So what do we do with this thing? And so then you do some research and find some old cookbooks that you got. In the case of liver, we found a nice country liver pate recipe that we went to town on and actually made probably 7 or 8 large country liver pates that we then froze and took out over time and you know, eat it over the course of the year, which was great. Initially, it was great, but then you're also faced with the monotony of eating the same thing over and over again. So
now, one of the advantages, I guess, is that, and you can see this with animal kills, with, you know, if you look at the alpha male in a pack that's feeding on a prey that it's killed, it's eating the organ meat. It's eating the stuff that would often not be eaten by folks. But I mean, so there's fantastic nutritional value and protein and caloric value in those kinds of meats, right?
If you really get into the meat-eating world, liver is really known as a superfood. Most people don't eat it today, but it is just so good for you, as long as, of course, with the caveat that it comes from an animal that is raised well and itself has eaten well.
So what's the most surprising thing that you found from your experience of trying to eat the whole hog?
Yeah, I would say for me, it's being willing to take risk, because you're doing things you haven't done before, and inevitably you're not going to do it well the first time. And so there's a bit of a risk in learning these skills. Like anything, it's an art form, and you need to practice to get good at it. So we've had lots of cases where things haven't gone quite as planned. Like in the article that I wrote, I talked about prosciutto. The first time we did that, you have to hang it in a cellar. You have to manage the humidity levels. You have to salt it first, and all these things and steps you have to do, and then time. So you have a year and a half later where it's hanging there and you finally get to try it, and crap, you had too much salt in your original recipe. And it just, the whole thing just is way too salty to enjoy. So in that case, we ended up boiling the prosciutto meat to release some of the salt, and then re-drying it in a dehydrator and eating it as jerky, which made it palatable and got rid of a lot of the salt. So things like that, where you have to risk losing significant portion of meat just to try and develop these skills.
So for folks who aren't raising their own hogs, but like the idea of not throwing away the wrapper on their food, so to speak, how do people start?
Let's look at bacon, for example. You can go to a butcher close by and find a slab of bacon. And this is more going to trying to develop new skills. So you can try and preserve and flavor your own bacon at home. There's lots of recipes where you can try and do that. And it's a great skill. It's fun. And you've made your own bacon. So I would encourage people to try things like that. And then just look up recipes online if you want to try it. Pate, then go ahead. Go to the butcher, ask for the liver. Try and make your own sausages at home. There's all sorts of different skills you can try and learn. It's pretty fun.
Well, thanks very much for sharing your adventure and for sharing your advice on how to go from nose to tail with your hog.
Anytime, Wayne.
That was Ken Dam in Linden, Ontario, where he is baking up a storm. So, here we are at the end of this episode of Harrismith Radio. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please consider subscribing to this podcast at Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast player. And please, tell your friends and family. Got feedback? We'd love to hear it. You can email us at letters@harrismithmag.com. That URL, harrismithmag.com, is also where you can order subscriptions online. And you can find Harrismith Magazine on newsstands of selected stores across Canada. Until next time, for Harrismith Radio, I'm Wayne McPhail. And also, until next time, remember these four words: make, grow, sustain, share. Tune in for the next episode of Harrismith Radio.